went through our windows in early autumn, then passed into a kind of hibernation. Hugh and I were away until right before Christmas, and when we returned and cranked up the heat, the butterflies, mainly tortoise shells, dozens and dozens of them, awoke, wrongly believing that spring had arrived. They were on all the second-floor windows, batting against the panes, desperate to get out. As symbols go, they're a bit too sweet. Right for Lisa, but all wrong for Tiffany, who'd have been better represented by something more dynamic. Crows, maybe. Two big ones flew down the chimney of my office that winter and tore the place apart, systematically overturning and then shitting on everything I cared about. What, I wondered, placing the cucumbers back over my eyes, would my symbol be? The last time I saw my sister Tiffany was at the stage door at Symphony Hall in Boston. I'd just finished a show and was getting ready to sign books when I heard her say, "David! David! It's me!" We hadn't spoken in 4 years at that point, and I was shocked by her appearance. Tiffany always looked like my mother when she was young. Now she looked like my mother when she was old, though at the time she couldn't have been more than 45. "It's me! Tiffany." She held up a paper bag with the Starbucks logo on it. Her shoes looked like she'd found them in a trash can. "I have something for you." There was a security guard holding the stage door open, and I said to him, "Will you close that, please?" I had filled the house that night. I was in charge, Mr. Sedaris. "The door," I repeated. "I'd like for you to close it now." And so the man did. He shut the door in my sister's face, and I never saw her or spoke to her again. Not when she was evicted from her apartment, not when she was raped, not when she was hospitalized after her first suicide attempt. She was, I told myself, someone else's problem. I couldn't deal with her anymore. "Well," the rest of my family said, "it was Tiffany. Don't be too hard on yourself. We all know how she can be." Perhaps like the psychic, they were just telling me what I needed to hear, something to ease my conscience and make me feel that underneath it all, I'm no different from anyone else. They've always done that for me, my family. It's what keeps me coming back.
And while you're up there, check on my prostate. The summer after I turned 16, I took driver's ed from a coach at my high school and quickly realized that this was not for me. Turning invoked a great deal of anxiety, as did staying in my lane and parking. Oh, parking. That was the worst. I suppose I could have tried harder to overcome my fear and discomfort, but I didn't. And as a result, I have never gotten a ticket, made a car payment, or called anyone a fucking piece of shit asshole through an open or closed driver's side window. It's not that I never get angry, just that I never get angry the way people behind a wheel do. My fury isn't poetry, just greeting card prose. "Go to hell, you." What do you say when someone cuts you off in traffic? I asked a woman in Copenhagen whose book I was signing. "We're not big on cursing," she told me, "so the worst we're likely to come out with, and it's pretty common, is, 'Why don't you run around in my ass?'" There are asses in America where that might not be much of a threat. This is to say that though it would be dark in there and it probably wouldn't smell so great, at least you'd have some room to spread out. It would be more like a prison cell than, say, a coffin. I'd asked the same question a few years earlier in Amsterdam and learned that in the Netherlands you're more apt to bring a disease into it. Like if someone drives in a crazy way, it is normal to call them a cholera sufferer, a Dutch woman told me. Either that or a cancer whore. I'd never thought of stitching those two particular words together. A cancer whore, I asked. She nodded. I'm pretty sure it comes from The Hague. The following day, I checked out her story with a woman named Els, who said, oh, sure, cancer whore. I hear it all the time. You can also say cancer slut. She added that the words were pretty much the same in Dutch as they are in English. We say slet, she said. Kanker slet. Would you ever call someone a diabetes slet, I asked. She looked at me as if I were missing out on something so fundamental. It was a wonder I could dress myself in the morning. Of course not, she said. The disease has to be terminal. So, like, AIDS whore? Again, she seemed exasperated. AIDS? Never. Those poor people, that's not funny. If you want to be creative, you say something like dirty typhus mongoloid, which you hear a lot lately. She paused. Is that the right word, mongoloid? We would say person with Down syndrome, I told her. But I guess that when joined with the words dirty and typhus, it would be too long. Especially when you're passing someone on the highway. They're strange, the Dutch. After talking to Els, I met a man who frequently calls his 18-month-old daughter a little ball sack. Because, I mean, it's what you do, he explained. What do you mean it's what you do, I said. This is not what I do or anyone in my family does. I don't even call my ball sack a ball sack. He shrugged, Dutchily. In Vienna, I returned to my original question. What do Austrians yell out their car windows when they get angry? Well, a young woman told me, sometimes we will say, why don't you find a spot on my ass that you would like to lick and lick it? I'm guessing this is quicker to say and less awkward sounding in German. Even so, it lacks a certain something. You give them a choice of where to lick your ass, I guess? That doesn't sound like much of a threat, given that they could pick a spot on the side or up top where it's basically just your lower back. She agreed. And sometimes, if the bad driver is a female, we will call her a blood sausage. Is that because a woman has a period, I asked? Maybe. Later that night, I met a Bulgarian. In my country, you say to someone you hate, may you build a house from your kidney stones. Well, finally, I thought. This is essentially wishing someone an eternity of gut-wrenching pain, all for taking the parking space you wanted or not turning his blinker on. I've had 3 kidney stones in my life. each the size of a small piece of gravel you might find at the bottom of an aquarium, and each excruciating. The thought of passing enough of them to build an entire house, even if it was just big enough for a termite to live in, is unfathomable. Those Bulgarians don't fool around, though no one can come close to the Romanians. At a book signing in Boston, I met a woman from Bucharest. My publicist is Romanian, I told her. Not full-blooded, like you, but still, she can speak a little. Her favorite saying, taught to her by her grandmother, is, I shit in... Oh, God, what is that? I shit in your mother's mouth, she asked. That's probably what it was. It's a very popular curse. The woman walked away, and I thought, well, I can see why. I shit in your mother's mouth. Does it get any nastier than that? I discovered a year later, on my first trip to Bucharest, that actually, yes, it does. What's the absolute worst thing you've ever heard? I asked from the stage at the end of my reading. People lined up with answers. And I learned that, as in all Catholic and Eastern Orthodox countries, the most popular target when on the attack is the other person's mother. Thus, I fuck your mother's dead. I fuck your mother's Christ. I fuck your mother's icon. I fuck your mother's Easter. I fuck your mother's onion. I will make skis out of your mother's cross. And I fuck your mother's memorial cake. This is something you bake when a loved one dies. And there's a lot of cursing centered around it. The absolute worst being, I dragged my balls across your mother's memorial cake. From cherry to cherry. And to each of the candles. A young woman told me this. And when I repeated it to the fellow who drove me to the airport the following morning and who had previously been chatty, he fell silent. That is total devastation, he eventually said. I mean, wow. What kind of a person told you this? Was it a girl? Was she pretty? The Romanians really do lead the world when it comes to cursing. What have you got for me? I asked a woman from Transylvania who is now living in Vienna. Shove your hand up my ass and jerk off my shit, she offered. I was stunned. Anyone else would say, shove your hand up my ass, and then run out of imagination, I told her. You people, though, you just keep going. And that's what makes you the champions you are. Maybe it's not too late to learn how to drive, I thought. Watching as she walked out the door and onto the unsuspecting streets of Vienna, this poet, this queen, this glittering jewel in a city of flint.
The Comey Memo. It was mid-August on Emerald Isle, and so far no one had drowned or been attacked by sharks. This was good news for the local realtors, one of whom, a cheerful woman named Phyllis, had become a family friend. Hugh dropped by to see her the day after we arrived and returned an hour or so later with a flushed face. Guess who's staying 12 houses down? James Comey, that's who. He came into the office earlier this week and had his picture taken with Sherry. I went out to the deck where Gretchen was hanging up her wet swimsuit. You'll never believe who's staying 8 houses away, Jim Comey. She pulled a clothespin out of her mouth. "Wow, you're kidding." Next, I told my niece Madeline, who is 14. She looked up dully from her phone and said, "Who?" The woman behind the counter at the post office responded the same way. "You know," I told her, "the guy who's been all over the news lately?" "Oh my God," she said. "How long has he been here?" I had no idea, but didn't want to sound like I was out of the loop. "5 days, and he's only a few houses away from me." I could practically hear the phone being dialed as I left. "Guess who's on the 7400 block of Ocean Drive?" "You what?" Hugh said when I told him I'd told the postmistress. "Now everyone will know." I wrote my friend Lynette and was about to write our neighbor Lee when I found Hugh writing him. "It's my news, not yours," he hissed. Late that afternoon, we rented a golf cart. The girls took it out just before sunset and turned around in James Comey's driveway. "At least I think it was his," my sister-in-law Kathy reported at dinner that night. "There was a black SUV with Virginia plates and dark windows parked out front." After eating, we all jumped into the golf cart and drove by the house twice. "Look, lights are on." Rental units turned over at noon the following day, so we never got a chance to see him, this former director of the FBI, whom we all hated, until someone we hated even more fired him. "Oh, well," Amy said. "It was fun to be excited for a while. Now we can all go back to doing nothing." Aside from Jim Comey, the big topic that week was our father, who was supposed to join us but had to cancel when his ride fell through. He'd lost his license earlier in the summer, and we'd all drawn a collective sigh of relief. Now we learned that he'd returned to the DMV with a letter from his eye doctor and gotten it back. "I followed him home from a dental appointment last week and couldn't believe it," Kathy said late one evening, lighting a cigarette on the deck that overlooks the ocean. "He has double vision and was all over the road. It's a miracle he didn't hit someone." My father lives on his Social Security. He won't touch his savings or investments, which are substantial, as he wants to leave as much as possible to his children. It's what kept him alive during the Obama years, the hope that whoever succeeded him would eliminate the estate tax. It would be the perfect irony, then, for him to get into an accident and lose everything in a lawsuit. Lisa's fear is that he'll kill a child. None of the rest of us have gotten that specific, though I suppose she has a point. Killing a toddler sounds a lot worse than killing a fellow 94-year-old. "I'm getting regular calls from the neighbors now," Amy told me. "So are Paul and Lisa." "Y'all need to be doing more for your father," they say. "He's too old to be living in that big house all on his own." I thought of the last time I'd visited him, 2 years earlier. Hugh and I were driving from Emerald Isle to the Raleigh airport and thought we'd drop in before flying back to England. I phoned again and again to say we were coming and left any number of messages. He hadn't responded, though, and because of his age, I started to wonder if maybe he was dead. On the 3-hour ride to the house, I considered how probable this actually was. "Why don't you go in first?" I said to Hugh when we got to the house. "Hello?" he called, sticking his head in the door. I stood behind him and looked through the window to see my father scuttling around the corner. "Hey now, this is a surprise." I followed Hugh into the kitchen. "I left 5 or 6 messages," I said, relieved by how relieved I felt. I'm guessing he'd set his air conditioner on 98, 2 degrees cooler than it was outside, which I didn't even know was possible. The heat and stillness made everything I saw look worse. My father's stove stopped working years ago, so he used his microwave to boil water and make us cups of instant coffee. We stood by the refrigerator, sweating. Then he asked if Hugh would advise him on a painting he had. "It's just here, around the corner," he said, grabbing a flashlight and stepping into what used to be a hallway, but now had a chair and a table loaded with papers in it. "Is the overhead light out?" I asked. "Want me to change it?" "No, it's fine," my father said. "So you use the flashlight to save electricity," he explained. We saw the painting my father was referring to the way a burglar might, the beam roving from spot to spot before sliding to the floor.
"If he won't move, why won't he at least get a housekeeper to come in once a week?" Hugh asked after we'd left and were on our way to the airport, me so depressed I was finding it hard to breathe. "Better yet, he could hire someone to live with him."
"That person might rip him off," I whispered.
"Why are you whispering?" Hugh asked.
"So the people in the next car won't know there's a broken stove at my father's house they can steal."
Even if conditions hadn't grown worse over the past 2 years, my father would need to make some sort of change. "What I can't understand," I said to Amy on the beach one afternoon, "is not wanting to move. Who wouldn't prefer a new environment, a clean slate? He can afford to keep his house exactly as it is, could pay someone to drive him over every day and wait outside while he stacks up junk mail."
"You're trying to convince me?" Amy asked.
"The one who has a second apartment 2 blocks from her first apartment just so she can get away from her rabbit for a couple hours a day?"
According to Kathy, Lisa took my father to look at 2 different retirement communities not far from his house in Raleigh.
"Not nursing homes," my sister assured him. "There are people as young as 65 living here."
"Your dad said he liked the first place, but when an apartment opened up, he claimed he couldn't possibly move until he fixes up the house he's living in."
"He's been saying that for 50 years, I told her.
Amy reached for her water bottle. "Dad refuses to move, and when I tell his neighbors that, they say, 'Well, then you need to make him.' They're all thinking we don't care, but how do you make Dad do something?"
"Part of the problem," I explained to Hugh, who was stretched out beside me with a floppy hat over his face, "is that our father hates old people. Always has. If everyone else in the retirement home was 20, he'd be a lot more likely to give it a try, especially if they were all girls, and all they were allowed to wear were bikini bottoms." I rubbed some sunblock into my reddening forehead. "I can't believe we missed James Comey." 2 days later, Amy, Hugh, and I headed to Raleigh, the plan being to drop by my dad's place before continuing on to the airport. At a Starbucks a few miles from his house, we picked up 4 cups of coffee. I was holding one for myself and another for my father when we walked through his front door.
"We're here!"
He wasn't in the kitchen, so after pausing to note the pair of briefs balled up and lying on my mother's beloved butcher block table, we moved down the hall and looked into bedrooms I hadn't seen in years. Each was in the same state. His first step is to move in a table he can use as a desk. This will eventually be piled so high with papers that the stacks will topple onto the floor or, likelier still, into boxes that sit on the floor and have even more papers in them. The beds will have towering stacks upon them as well, and the various mounds will continue to grow until he crowds himself out and moves on to the next bedroom. There are 5 of them, including his own, which is at the end of the hall.
"Dad?"
10 years earlier, my father, Amy, and I attended a wedding in Florida and stayed at a hotel in Delray Beach. "How did you sleep?" I asked over breakfast the next morning. He thought for a moment.
"I slept like a doll."
Perhaps he meant I slept like a baby and it came out wrong, but ever since, it's what everyone in my family says. "I slept like a doll." My father so loved his bed at the hotel that Amy and I bought him one, explaining that what made it nice wasn't just the mattress, but the sheets, which were high quality and, more important still, clean. The bed my father slept on in Florida would have vomited its stuffing had it seen its filthy twin in North Carolina. There was a narrow space for a person to lie on, but the rest of it, like the rest of the room itself, was piled high with bank statements, along with catalogs and belts and pages torn from newspapers. It was hard to pick out any one thing. Rather, it blurred into a continuous mass, sort of like a glacier. Overlooking it all, balanced atop a stack of 20-year-old golf magazines on his high boy were a 6 photos of the family taken on Emerald Isle in 1981 and arranged under glass in a single frame.
In them, Lisa looks amazing. All us kids do. It was that moment in a family's life when everything is golden. Literally, our tans were phenomenal, but so was our outlook. Ranging in age from 12 to 24, my brother, sisters, and I gazed into the future and saw only promise. It's not like we don't see it now. We're not pessimists, exactly. But in late middle age, when you envision your life 10 years down the line, you're more likely to see a bedpan than a Tony Award. That our younger, cuter, infinitely more hopeful selves oversaw such total chaos made it all the sadder. I was just wondering what the house would look like had my mother been the surviving parent when I noticed my father on the deck just off his bedroom, staring into a tree. I'd last seen him a month earlier and had noticed how hunched over he was, not bent into the shape of a question mark the way some people his age are, but still it made him look frailer. "Hey," he said as I opened the sliding glass door. "There you are." He wore white tennis shorts with a beige T-shirt and matching socks. Everything looked too big on him, his watch, his glasses, even his teeth, which is odd as they're completely his own. When he stepped forward to hug me, I noticed 4 mean-looking bruises on his arm. They weren't purple but black and had cotton balls over them, held down with masking tape. "We brought you a cup of coffee," I said. "Fantastic." The living room was the last semi-presentable patch of territory in my father's house, the only one without a desk in it, so we retired there. "Gosh, you all look terrific," he said, taking a seat on the sofa. "So tanned and healthy." "What happened to your arm?" I asked. "I fell," he told me, waving away my concern. "It happens sometimes when I turn around too quickly." "So you fall, and then what?" "I crawl around for a while until I come to a chair or something, and then I lift myself up." "Hey," he said to Amy, no doubt eager to change the subject, "I pulled out a few things I thought you might like." He gestured to a pile on a low table beside the sofa. "There's a straw hat that belonged to your mother and some pocketbooks." "I don't really wear hats," Amy told him. I didn't want my father to feel bad, so I picked it up. "The only bit that really says woman is the bow," I said, walking into the bathroom to try it on and noticing that both the sinks were filled with stuffed animals. It was like they had planned to take a bath and were just waiting for someone to turn the water on. What on earth, I thought. "I can't believe that the straw is still in such good shape," I called into the other room. "Isn't it?" my father called back. "I've got a little something for you, too," he said as I reclaimed my seat, the hat still on my head. "Just a few things I knew you'd like." On top of my pile were 2 Bruegel postcards. Both were in inexpensive plastic frames, bought that way, I assumed. "He's someone you like, right?" "Yes," I said. "Thank you so much." Beneath the postcards were a couple of nature calendars, the first of which had a fox on the cover, nuzzling her kit. "Isn't that terrific? I thought maybe you'd want to frame it." "Hmm," I said. My father has criticized every gift I've ever given him. His disapproval is consistently swift and hard, but for some reason I can never respond in kind. "How nice," I told him. The second calendar was devoted to chimps. "I know how much you like them. And these photos, I'm telling you, they're just outstanding." I opened it to March and saw an adult male with his arms crossed, not defiantly, but as if he were trying to make up his mind about something, whether to rip off the photographer's hands or start with his face, most likely. Then I noticed that the calendar was 2 years old. "Well," I announced, looking at my watch, "I guess we'd better get going." Amy and I were too shaken up to say much of anything in the car. Underpants on Mom's butcher block table. so we just looked out the windows until we reached the airport. There we learned there was weather in Washington, D.C., where Hugh and I were headed. "Well, where isn't there weather?" I whined, looking up at the board. "Can't they be more specific?" Amy's flight to New York had been affected by distant storms as well. It was one of those times when your flights are delayed and then delayed again. The D.C. departure time moved from 7 to 8, then eventually to 9:45. Amy's flight was canceled altogether, so she wound up catching a taxi and spending the night in a hotel. After sitting around for a while, Hugh and I decided we might as well eat dinner. There weren't many choices at that hour, so we went to the 42nd Street Oyster Bar. "This is where my mom and dad were the night Martin Luther King was assassinated," I said to Hugh after we had ordered. "Not here at the airport, obviously, but at their original location downtown." I told him how someone had stepped out of the kitchen to announce the news and how everyone but my parents had applauded. Our family hadn't been in the South very long, and that was a real eye-opener. "Hmm," Hugh said, pulling out his phone. "I'm just going to text Amy and see if she was able to book a flight for tomorrow morning." I looked around at our fellow diners, all on their way to somewhere else, but all I could think about was my father, crawling through his house in search of a chair he could use to hoist himself up. He'd said it so matter-of-factly, "What I do," as if I'd asked how he makes a sandwich. There are any number of people who have to live like that when they get to be terribly old, but for him, it's a choice. My father could have a nice place. There could be help at the ready should he fall, a cook, a driver, someone to make the bed every morning. He's just too cheap to pay for it. "The killer," I said to Hugh, who had finished texting Amy and was now texting someone else, "is that he's saving the money to give to his kids, who will spend it wildly, without even thinking. Maybe not Lisa, but you've seen everyone else in action. A person could live handsomely on the money we waste over the course of a given year, and here's our father wandering from room to room with a flashlight? He falls and gets banged up, then covers his bruises with cotton balls and masking tape because Band-Aids are too expensive? Why don't you pay to get him a driver?" Hugh asked. "Because he can afford it on his own," I told him. Of course, Hugh was right. I should at least offer to pay. Like anyone else, my father loves free stuff. I was hesitating in part because he'd cut me out of his will. "You told me you wanted to be cut out," he'd said 5 years earlier when I confronted him about it. "When?" I asked. "I don't know, but you did." There was no way on earth that this was true. In that respect, my father is very much like the current president. "There were 1.5 million people at my inauguration, the biggest crowd ever, 1.5 million. It's hard to even call it lying. Rather, it's a form of insistence. "This is the way I need it to be, goddammit." He then told me I could pick something out of the house, and he'd set it aside for me to inherit. I looked around at the furniture, all of it covered with papers, and at the gloomy artwork he and my mother had bought in the 70s. "There's a guide for mixing drinks you have downstairs behind the bar," I said. "A body paperback from 1960, illustrated by a cartoonist named Vip. I wouldn't mind having that, I suppose." "But you don't even drink," he said. I sighed. "You know what? You're right. It's better you give it to Amy or Paul. One of them might want a pink squirrel some night." Our food was delivered, and I said to Hugh, "I don't remember ever fighting with my mom, but with me and my dad it was constant. Once in high school, he was shouting at me for something or other, running too much bathwater maybe, and I shouted back, 'You are going to die alone.' Isn't that awful?" I pushed some shrimp and grits around my plate. Now here he is, trying to do just that, die alone. And everyone's giving him a hard time about it. When our check came, I paid. He went to our gate, but there was still an hour to kill before boarding, so I took a walk from one end of the terminal to the other, then back again, passing the now shuttered Brooks Brothers, the Starbucks, the bookstore. This terminal didn't exist when I lived in Chicago or New York. The Raleigh airport was smaller and slower back then. I'd fly home for a visit and wait at the baggage claim for half an hour before calling the house. My father would answer, a bad sign, as it was he who was supposed to pick me up. "Did you forget I was flying in?" I'd ask. "I told you my plane was landing at 6. "Well, it's not 6 o'clock yet." "Dad, it's 6:30. "No, it's not." I'm looking at the clock in the airport and at my watch, and both say 6:30. "Well, it's sure as hell not 6:30 here, but I'm on my way. I'm leaving the house right now." 20 minutes later, I'd phone again, and again he would pick up. I could hear his TV in the background. "I told you I'm on my way, Jesus." I'd wish then that I could afford to go to the ticket counter and buy a seat on the next plane back to where I'd come from. My father would arrive to pick me up, and I'd be gone, a speck in the sky. The secret to Dad's longevity isn't diet or exercise or even his genes, I've often said to Paul and my sisters. He's just late for death, the way he's been late for everything else all his life. There are things I avoid talking about with my father now. Politics, for instance. He's always operated on the assumption that I don't know anything, can't know anything, really. The issues are as far beyond my grasp as they are for the chimps in the calendar he gave me. Sure, one might pull a lever in a voting booth, but there could be no actual thought behind it. The fight we had following Trump's election had been particularly ugly, and we could easily have it again every hour of every day. I don't want to, though. Don't want what could be the last words we say to each other to be ugly. It's why I didn't bring up Jim Comey during our visit. Easier to put on a straw hat that once belonged to my mother, and to accept with grace the framed postcards and nature calendars I dropped into an airport trash can before boarding my flight to Washington. It wasn't where they belonged, necessarily. It was just where they ended up.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Calypso, written by David Sedaris and read by the author. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. With original music composed and performed by Daniel Hart. Recorded by Patrick Fitzgerald at Polarity Post. Edited by John Colucci. Mixed and mastered by Tommy Herron. Live recordings of Little Guy, Your English Is So Good, and While You're Up There, Check on My Prostate, courtesy of Hamer Hall Arts Center, Melbourne, Australia. Live recording of I'm Still Standing, courtesy of Popejoy Hall, University of New Mexico, Chris Pacheco, audio engineer. Calypso is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by David Sedaris. Audio production copyright 2018 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.